And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor. It's a nice hot day. We got a nice hot subject for you. It'll come up at about the half hour point. Well, it's all hot, but you ain't listening to CBC. You're going to be at 5:30. We'll be talking to a former Undersecretary of State in the administration of Ronald Reagan, former editor of the Wall Street Journal, an associate editor of the Wall Street Journal, Paul Craig Roberts. He has a number of columns in Counterpunch. I invite you to go to counterpunch.org, and I would suggest you go to search, write Paul Craig Roberts, and you will get just a ton of excellent columns. And he is skeptical and critical, etc., about U.S. intentions regarding Iran, and he will explain why. He has a new column in today's Counterpunch. I'm looking for the title of it as I speak. His theme is pretty simple, that yes, indeed, the U.S. is meddling because it's in their nature. It's kind of like leopards and spots, things like that. Phil Conlon has actually decided to join us. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil. I'm doing well. But I don't walk as fast as I used to.
You don't walk as fast?
Yeah, I don't.
Talk as fast. Here's what we said in the Marine Corps. Well, then you have to run.
I'll take that down.
Are you tired? Yes, sir. No, you're not.
Oh, no, sir. I'm not tired.
You are not tired. So then after you run for about an hour, you know, then he says, are you tired? And you say, okay. No. He says, good, because we're going to run some more. It is sadism, but it's funny. What's difficult to stand against today is sweet to remember. What was difficult to stand against before is sweet to remember today. But leading off today, we're going to talk to a political action chairman at CUPE Local 3906, and his name is Max Haven. We're going to talk to him about a meeting going on at York University. I want to announce that this coming Sunday, Barry Zwicker is going to be speaking, and it'll be Sunday at 1:30 at 280 Queen Street, and that's the Friendship Society at 280 Queen Street, Sunday, 1:30. It's Barry Zwicker, and people know Barry. He's one of the celebrated investigative journalists of Canada. And we had him on the program some time back. But anyhow, you might want to attend that. I think he's speaking about the condition status of the traditional left/progressive community. He must be using a high-powered microscope. But at any rate, he's going to talk about it. I'll remind you again, at 5:30, we're going to be speaking to Paul Craig Roberts about his column in today's Counterpunch, saying, yes, indeed, the U.S. administration is meddling and planning to overthrow the government of Iran. And we'll talk about that. But right now, I think we're already joined by Max Haven. Are you there, Max?
Yes, hello.
Hey, Max, thanks very much. You are with Local 3906 in Political Action, and you took some political action recently at York University over the issue of a conference. Can you tell us about the action you took and why, and then if you can tell us a little bit about the conference, we'd like our listeners to know.
Sure. Yeah, I'm the chair of the Political Action Committee at CUPE Local 3906, which represents part-time precarious workers at McMaster University. And we staged a protest along with a group called Faculty for Palestine at the offices of Gary Goodyear, who's the MP for Cambridge and also the Minister of State for Science and Technology, over his intervention in a great organization called the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, which is sort of an impartial funding body for academic research. Now, what he had done is he had intervened and personally called the president of SHRC, that's the acronym for it, to try and put pressure on them to cut funding for an academic conference on peace in the Middle East, because he didn't happen to like the political approach that he assumed the conference had. The conference is called Israel-Palestine, Mapping Models for Statehood and Pathways for Peace, And it's occurring at, I believe it's starting tonight at York University and going for the next couple of days.
And boy, they have quite a list of people.
Yes, yes.
But what basis could he possibly object?
Well, he received complaints from a number of prominent pro-Israel policy organizations in Canada, including B'nai B'rith. But it seems he really took his direction, as the Harper administration has, from some of the more extremist elements of the pro-Israel lobby, including Jewish Defense League. And the argument was that because this conference even dared to speculate on the possibility of a quote-unquote one-state solution, that it was de facto anti-Semitic. And he, you know, without doing any research into the conference, it seems, simply decided that on the basis of this complaint, he would intervene very personally, breaking every standard of academic freedom. I mean, this is completely unprecedented and uncalled for.
Yeah, my understanding is that the former mayor, one of the people speaking, is a former mayor of Jerusalem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And many
and one of the most celebrated academics in Israel.
Yeah, yeah. And
he would be very surprised to find out about his anti-Semitism.
Yeah, indeed. And many of the academics who are coming to speak are Israeli and are part of the, you know, there are many of them are on the left, but a lot of them are very much in the mainstream. You know, mainstream newspaper commentators in Israel. It's certainly not outside the pale. This is just a very, very hasty and rash action by the federal government.
Well, yeah, but sort of staying in character, right? I mean, they like to be seen to be going that extra mile to win their credentials as the strongest ally of Israel, isn't it?
It's true. In fact, so much so that it's quite embarrassing. I mean, the statements that, for instance, Jason Kenney, MP Jason Kenney, has made, and Stephen Harper, you know, are frankly embarrassing on the world stage. They're completely uncritical and unquestioning support for the policies of, you know, a very right-wing government in the state of Israel right now, just completely without pretext and precedent.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to your, did you pick it, or how did you, what form did your, that take again? I mean,
yeah, we
and
had
and
a,
how, what was your reaction to it?
We had a short protest outside of, outside of Gary Goodyear's constituency office in Cambridge, and we held some signs and handed out leaflets, and you know, shared some information with the media. It was a very good response. I have to say that Goodyear isn't particularly popular in Cambridge, if our demonstration was any indication. People don't like...
Maybe you should run against him. You set the foundation.
Well, I'm not from Cambridge, so I don't know. I might be too much of an outsider.
Well, Ignatieff is not from Toronto.
Yeah. No, but people were very angry at statements he'd made earlier, a couple of months ago, about... he claimed that he didn't need to, despite the fact that he's Minister of State for Science and Technology, that he didn't need to answer questions about if he believed in evolution because he was a Christian, and therefore somehow it's not acceptable for him to even be asked the question. And then in you know, later on he said that, sort of quote-unquote, of course I believe in that. But then he made some very nebulous statements about how human beings are always evolving and society evolves. So it's still not clear exactly what his position on, you know, humans walking the earth with dinosaurs and Stockwell Day and all the rest of the conservative brass.
Yes, Stockwell Day is one of the few persuasive arguments that we haven't gotten very far in evolution.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, I congratulate you on that. Was there any complaint from the minister that trade unionists shouldn't be involved in these questions, or did he decide maybe he had to take his marbles and go home?
Yeah, he gave a statement to the Cambridge paper that he felt that he hadn't responded in disproportionately or poorly, but he didn't make a statement that I've read, at least, about trade unions. I mean, my union represents over 2,500 academic workers, and it's a sad state of affairs that, as things go now, it seems to be the most precarious and endangered academic workers who are at the front lines of standing up for academic freedom. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, the Canadian Association of University Teachers, which represents most of the faculty unions, is also doing a great job of really taking on Goodyear. Mm-hmm. Not only on this issue, but on his massive cut to academic funding and his movement for the universities towards a corporatized model.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Max Haven, he is a political action chair, I think, at QP 3906. Are you going to attend some of this conference? But do you have a favorite that you're kind of... when you look at down the list, is there people there you're thinking to yourself you want to hear them speak at this conference?
Well, two people definitely stand out for me that I've heard speak before. One of them is Jeff Halper, who's an activist in the Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolition. And he has a very astute analysis, and the thing that most stuck with me about what he said, as well as about the situation for Palestinians, is that the occupation in the occupied territories is a model that's being exported. It's a way that new technologies and surveillance of population is being exported around the world, and I think that's very true. You know, I was just in Palestine on a solidarity tour last month, and I really saw that in action. And, you know, as the economic crisis gets worse and worse, I think his predictions are going to be borne out unless we fight them. And the other person is Omar Barghouti, who will be speaking on the question of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. He's a very articulate speaker. Mm-hmm. And he'll be speaking on exactly what that means. Especially in terms of the cultural and academic boycott, which is, of course, very controversial.
Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't happen to know when he's going to be talking?
I don't have the schedule in front of me, no. Sorry.
But we live in this magic age. We just say Google and they'll find it, I guess.
Yeah.
Tell us quickly. You just said you were in. You had visited the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to Gaza?
I wasn't able to, no.
Did you try? I mean, you...
No, we were there. I was there with several other people on a solidarity tour, and our tour guides advised us that it wouldn't be worth trying to get in because
probably
we clearly wouldn't.
You would exit Israel a little earlier than you, or the area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Max at Haven, we're very grateful.
Thank you.
It sounds like an interesting program, and congratulations on your local and others, CUPE, standing up for the rights of academic rights of people to discuss this very important issue.
Yeah, I hope the conference goes extremely well, and I think the conference organizers are to be commended for, in a very academic, impartial, and responsible way, bringing these issues to the table in a time when the censorship against them is extremely strong.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Max.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Max Haven, Political Action Chairman, CUPE 3906. And that conference is starting tonight, is it? And Uri Davis, I know, is speaking there. Uri Davis is one of the more brilliant guys who's written about the issue of land confiscation. And we had him on this program. And by the way, we did have, our listeners will remember, we had Jeff Halper. Jeff Halper had just completed his voyage from Cyprus to Gaza. And at the suggestion of the guy who organized the voyage, he decided to return to Israel by just going to the gate leading to Israel, and was arrested, of course. But I don't know if the guy who suggested it, I hope he didn't. Oh, we thought that through. Jeff Halper's a great guy, and he gave us a terrific interview. We're very grateful to that. And I should just tell our listeners, if you don't know, Cynthia McKinney is, I believe, at this moment in Cyprus, where they have another voyage organized. And the Israeli Navy is saying they're not very enthusiastic about this. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. But Cynthia McKinney has issued a statement today. She's a real tiger and ought to be get more attention and support. She pointed out that the U.S. press completely ignores what she's doing. Former United States Congresswoman and strong friend of the Palestinian people. And she has been... attended conferences all over the world. She says that the Israeli media, Haaretz and others, are covering what she's doing at the moment. But it is getting no coverage in the United States, probably not even in her home city of Atlanta. We probably ask Paul Craig Roberts, as I understand, he lives in Atlanta. And the other news from that region is that Jimmy Carter, during all these headlines about Iran, Jimmy Carter has been in Gaza, and he met with the political leadership of Hamas, and he wants to cut the Gordian knot. He says we should, of course, deal with, negotiate with Hamas. So we'll see how much trouble he gets into for that. Very curious thing, that when he was president of the United States, Ramsey Clark went to visit Iran shortly after the Islamic Revolution. If you don't remember, it was like egg all over the shirt front of Jimmy Carter, and any rate, Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, and I guess we can call him a friend of our show, he went there and gave a speech. And so the U.S. government said, well, we may arrest Ramsey Clark on his return. And so the question was, you know, will they do it? And Ramsey said he was prepared to be arrested, and so he came back and they didn't go forward with it. So then you move them forward in time. And Jimmy Carter recently, in the last couple of years, has both written and spoken out and made trips in which there was talk that he ought to be arrested. So, you know, in politics, you want to watch out, you know, between you, one day you're standing outside the building and next you're inside and somebody's looking at you. Not that this is the best segue, but we're going to now talk a little bit about the Islamic Republic and the elections there and all the turmoil. And I want to bring some news into this matter that doesn't seem to be, in my view, adequately covered. The first is that Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has issued his second statement about the election. First, in his first statement, he congratulated Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on his victory. His statement yesterday, this is Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, said the U.S. is definitely meddling in the affairs of Iran and others. I assume he means Britain, UK, France. And he said this: you're not impressing those nations in the world who respect sovereignty of states and who have their own problems with superpowers who think they can interfere anytime they feel like it. And so it's important, in my view, that this be called to people's attention. There's also a great column in Global Research. I bet most of our listeners already know how to find it, but I've already said Global Research, so you can go to that. But James Petras. James Petras is, again, one of the most respected intellectuals in North America and around the world, and for his commentary on struggles, particularly in South America, of countries for independence and of also of progressive and working class movements for social gain. That's James Petras. He has a piece, the title of which is Iranian Elections, The Stolen Elections Hoax. And that's Global Research, June 18, 2009. Further, it should be noted that Russia, China, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and here's my favorite, Iraq, have recognized the election of Ahmadinejad. You know, when Mr. Obama and all of his friends talk about these things, you know, they have their favorite guy in Baghdad, and their favorite guy in Baghdad says, congratulations, President Ahmadinejad. And meanwhile, we're getting along, you know, the Twitterites are just shocked. Anyhow, apropos of Twitters, if the Twitter gang wants to help out, I suggest that they give every Iranian the technological capacity to Twitter. Then they'll get some really wild Twittering. A lot more fun than the stuff that they're dishing out at the moment. But at any rate, Iraq, India, China, and on the other side, we have the champions of democracy. We have Mr. Sarkozy, who, to show he means business, he says Iran has stole their election, says they're oppressing the people, and steps have to be taken. He didn't say what. And to show he means business, he said the burqa is not welcome in France. So he's your friend. And that's Sarkozy. And of course, as we know, Berlusconi, another champion of women. By the way, CNN is telling a story, so it's about women. You know, that when they talk about why did we invade Iraq, pardon me, well, Iraq too, but Afghanistan, it's about the women. You say, I don't think so. Anyway, so they said that this was the issue. Well, Berlusconi, as we know, is a champion of women's rights and of his own rights with women. He just recently gave $10,000 diamond necklace to a 17-year-old girl on her birthday. She was the daughter of a friend, so that makes it okay. And his wife, I think, is just rolling over in delight. Anyhow, so that's, we know that Berlusconi is a champion of women's rights, and he's standing up today courageously. I mean, on the side of anybody who will make trouble for the Islamic Republic, he's with them. And same goes for Mr. Kushner, who we reported on Mr. Kushner when they had the terrible tsunami hit Myanmar. The French Navy said, we're going to bring in rice. This is a terrible emergency. We have to get in there and help those people. And Myanmar says, don't you bring your warships into our waters, or you will regret it. So the mighty French Navy paused, thinking about that and being sent to the bottom. And they said, well, you know, we have the rice. It's very important that people get the rice. Well, we later interviewed people who followed it very closely. It turned out the ships turned and went away, but they didn't have any rice. It's a thought that counts. Send a warship that doesn't have any rice, saying you're bringing rice. But that's because you want to bring rice in a warship. So they have taken sand. And, of course, the U.S. is debating between should we hit them or speak out today, tomorrow, and they're debating that today or tomorrow. And the U.K. has frozen, $1.5 billion in Iranian assets. But they say they're not meddling in anybody's internal affairs. They just thought this would be a good time to do that. So I'm frankly not very impressed. What I suggest you do is go to counterpunch.org. There is about four articles today. One by, I think the man's name is Amin. I beg his pardon if I got his name wrong. And it might be El Amin. I know Mr. Roberts, who we're going to speak to later, is very high on his article. It's a very detailed analysis of the vote in the Islamic Republic. Not only is it well argued and significant detail, but he does a little comparison between votes elsewhere, like the Gore Bush matter, and what happened, and in number of places in the world where you've had disputed elections. And so I'd highly recommend that article as well. And who else have we? Do we leave anybody out in terms of statements? I'll go back again. Hugo Chavez. Incidentally, Hugo Chavez won his election by more than 60%, and immediately they said, that was a fraud, and we need a color revolution.
Well, Phil, we did fail to mention a news report that appeared like a lightning stroke and disappeared from the Toronto Star yesterday, which is that the president and prime minister of Israel expressed their solidarity with the
I left out Netanyahu, right. Another very good friend of the
then they pulled the story.
Well, no, actually, I think they're trying to get this a little bit coordinated, they had a problem with when they went to war the first time with Iraq. And I will never forget, I had a Tom Brokaw moment. I was watching Tom Brokaw. And Saddam Hussein wanted to draw Israel into it because he knew the Arab states were aligned against him because he had entered, his soldiers had gone into Kuwait, which is a long story, but they had done that. And they said Kuwait belonged to them. So the Arab states were angry, and they had taken a stand. But Saddam said, well, you know, it's really the U.S. and Israel. So he fired some missiles. And a couple of them were very pathetic, but they landed. And so I was watching the news, and Tom Brokaw came out, and he said, we have news tonight that Iraqi missiles have struck Israel. And he said the U.S. State Department and others are urging Israel to restrain itself. But he said, take it from me, I'm a veteran journalist, I've been to Israel many times. He said, they're going to react. They don't tolerate this kind of stuff. They're going to act. And so I waited. They didn't act. Because it turns out somebody in Washington can pick up a phone. And guess what? You don't do nothing. So then when they decided to attack Iraq, at that time, under Bush's leadership, Israel was not part of the coalition. So they do have to coordinate themselves because, of course, in the Middle East, it's a highly sensitive stuff. But you're right. Netanyahu, it was certainly seen because I saw it, and I'm not glued to my television set. I do other things, but I managed to see that. There have been some others. The widow of the Shah has said that she's right there with him, and the Shah's son, he's right there. And I saw the demonstrations in Los Angeles and London, and I noticed that they had the good old Shah's flag out
here too in Toronto as well.
Yeah. Well, And I'd say, well, that's your business. Good for you. No, listen, I'm not getting it. Far be it for me to tell you guys how to do your business. I know, you know, but it might interest your soulmates abroad. At any rate, so that's the kind of matter we have. We think this is very dangerous times, and that's why we've asked Paul Craig Roberts to join us, and he will be, we hope, in about 5 minutes. Well, I know he's on, he's being interviewed by some international television outfit. So we said, go ahead. Yeah, we, as long as we can get a chance to talk about his column in today's Counterpunch, and the title of which is the U.S. Regime Change Recipe for Iran. His writings are quite interesting. I do recommend them. Oh, by the way, there's another matter I want to call everyone's attention. The day following the election, and this is it for those of you who admire Mr. Hudson, who wrote the book Super Imperialism. Michael Hudson, we had him as a guest. If you weren't a guest on our show, we never talk about you. So he must have been a guest. So Michael Hudson, who wrote the book Super Imperialism, he's a brilliant man. He was most interested in a conference that took place 2 days after the Iranian election. It was attended by Ahmadinejad. And at the conference was the president of China and the president of Russia, Mr. Medvedev, the leader of India, and I'm trying to remember who else. But that was a very important gathering. And what they were talking about, according to Michael Hudson, was the desire of these states to combine and coordinate themselves in a struggle against the U.S. dollar. Because they feel they're being taken for a ride by this weird dollar, which is the, you know, the international currency. And this has been an old issue. Can, you know, why is the U.S. dollar our common currency? And has IMF World Bank status. So they have held a conference, and Ahmadinejad attended. And I don't know what Mr. Medvedev said, and I don't know what Mr. Hu said. Hu is kind of a character from the old Abbott Costello routine. President Hu, he said, I don't know him, that. But Ahmadinejad was quoted, and he said, the days of empire are coming to an end. And he said, the days of imperial superpower hegemony are coming to an end. Of course, that's when some people in Tehran wanted to recall him home, and he is back. But it is interesting what was going on there and why he struck that tone. I could find his exact quotes somewhere, but it's clear Russia, China, India, and others were delighted he was there. Here's what I would say. We ought to be as interested in his full remarks as we are in whatever Mr. Obama has to say when he's spent all that time in front of a microphone. Our media ought to tell us in detail what was said at that conference in Russia. It was in the old city of Sverdlovsk, which is no longer. Do you know the Russian name for that, Phil, by the way? I could try it. It's
Yekaterinburg or something like that, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yekaterin.
I didn't know you were going to start singing.
Yeah.
Okay. It's whatever Phil said. It used to be
Sverdlovsk.
But
that's the same place as Sverdlovsk, okay.
That's Sverdlovsk. Okay. You were probably there. Yeah. I went. That's an important conference. Yeah. Michael Hudson says, hey, look, this was a showdown. Not a showdown. This was a conference to talk about international financial crisis and the function of currencies, all currencies, but particularly that of the U.S. dollar. He said the United States asked if they could attend as an observer, and they were told no. So, I don't know. Maybe they should take that to the Grand Council of Ayatollahs and see. Can we appeal this? Find out. But they were told no. But their dollar would be under discussion. So why doesn't the Globe and Mail give us a full report of that? Why doesn't the CBC put on their site, if you want to see the remarks of President Medvedev, of President Ahmadinejad, of President Hu, it's right here. Click, click. And then you'll get interesting analysis. By the way, the Imam Khamenei gave a rather important talk on Friday and everybody talked about what he said, but to my knowledge, they haven't reproduced it. Have you seen it?
No.
So that you can...
I've seen it filtered through Western reporters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not the remarks themselves.
Yeah. So, yeah, filtered. Well, again, we're shortly we're talking to Paul Craig Roberts, and I would remind you, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and some of you have. I want to thank you very much. People have been sending me stuff, and I am very grateful. I respect anybody who tells me what they think and gives me information. That's fine. And so I thank them for that, and a lot of helpful things. And actually, I got one today, Phil, asking if you had been on CBC.
I did. I did call in Metro Morning this morning and try to defend the rights of labor to organize itself when working for a city and to go on strike.
Because why didn't you give us your first interview? I didn't know.
Well, it was just, I'm just struck by the level of malevolence directed at the strikers, right?
Yeah.
And
well, we'll come
whatever the issues are.
Maybe at the end of the program we can get back to that. But at the moment, we are now joined by Paul Craig Roberts, who served as Undersecretary in the Treasury Department, I believe, of the Reagan administration. He was also Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal, and he has written a number of terrific columns that appeared in Counterpunch. I suggest you go to counterpunch.org, just write, and in search, put Paul Craig Roberts, and you will get a feast of interesting material. Mr. Roberts, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks very much for joining us. Hey, you're hard to keep up with. I was reading your columns, and then I realized I better check today, and you have a new one today, and I'd like to start right there. Because this is the number one issue, if I can judge by CNN, and that is the Islamic Republic, various and others around the world have said it appears U.S. is meddling and has a plan to try to remove this present government. Judging by your column, I think you probably agree with that thesis. Can you tell us why?
Well, I don't think there's any appearance to it. It's just hard fact that it's been known for over 2 years when it was announced by ABC News television, by the London Telegraph, and by Cy Hirsch and the New Yorker and a variety of other mainstream media sites that the United States had ordered and funded a black ops or a psychological ops program to destabilize and topple the Iranian regime. Mm-hmm. We also have the London Telegraph's word for it that the Bush administration official John Bolton, in an editorial conference with that newspaper, laid out the U.S. strategy. He said, first, we try to destabilize the regime by fomenting a popular revolution, you know, another color revolution, and failing that, we strike them militarily. So I don't think there's any questions about it. And of course, all of the protest, everything about the protest, shows that it's a CIA orchestration. There can't be any doubt about it because the hand is everywhere. Now, this doesn't mean that all of the young, sectorized, westernized youth in Tehran are being are paid CIA officers. I think that they are sincere. They want to escape from the strict moral codes of Islam, and there can be no doubt that they would like to be rid of that. Not that Mousavi would rid them of it, and I think there's also no doubt that there are splits among the top ruling Ayatollahs. Several of them have had their political ambitions put on the back burner by others. You know, wherever there's any form of democracy, competition, egos get in the way and dissension, and I'm absolutely certain that the high muckety mucks among the mullahs are at each other's throats. And I think the...
Providing something of an opportunity.
Right. But I also don't think that this election was stolen. Musavi is widely seen, I think that I got his name right, some of his names, and I'm not very good at language. But Musavi is seen within Iran as the man of Rafsanjani. He's the way that Rafsanjani hopes to get back into power. And of course, Ahmadinejad defeated Rafsanjani in the presidential election by the same percentage that he has now defeated Musavi. And since the two in Iran are perceived as the same, essentially, Musavi and Rafsanjani, there's nothing unusual about Ahmadinejad beating the two by the same vote. Mm-hmm. And we've now had a number of experts explain that there's no difficulty whatsoever in counting the votes in a few hours. There's one on Global Research Today, in Counterpunch. There's one on Lou Rockwell. The one on LouRockwell.com is from a Dutch professor who was for years an election observer for the various human rights organizations. And in their experience, he said that the largest voter precincts are 2,000 people. And if you have an 80% turnout, you've got 1,600 votes to count, and eight people can very easily count them and recount them and report them in 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And the person writing on Global Research, Counterpunch, says that the actual facts, without any speculation, is that the average, because in Iran, there were 45,713 ballot boxes. Mm-hmm. And given to know what the vote was, and so there's an average of 860 ballots per box. So there's no difficulty with poll people counting them and reporting. So all of that seems to be just more of the disinformation that we are hearing from the media.
Yeah, and in your analysis, by the way, too, and you point that out, that it they seem to be those who are wanting to keep the trouble, stirring. They seem to find a different story, different focus. They're not being consistent in what it is they're asking for. But you mentioned that there's something dubious about or suspicious about the way Musavi went at this, because he declared himself a winner.
Well, he, according to a large number of news reports, he declared himself a winner before the polls closed. According to other news reports, which I think were not aware that the voting had been extended when they made this report, but the rest said he declared himself the winner the instant the polls were closed, before any votes were counted. Well, now, this is a very curious thing to do. I mean, have we ever seen this before? Outside of maybe the Soviet Union during Stalin.
It would certainly be a provocation. I mean, it would be...
It's an obvious...
Because your followers then are going to say, well, our leader says we won, it's over.
Yeah. It's a preemptive move that prevents any other outcome. Mm-hmm. Because it then means that any other outcome you already have preempted because, oh, well, they stole it. Not one. They stole it. And we also have a tremendous amount of indication that these so-called protests were already organized and waiting in the wings. And even though I'm sure some people joined them spontaneously, these were not spontaneous protests in response to an election announcement of votes.
I tell you, I was impressed. I want to get your thoughts on this too, and it seems to play in with what you're saying. They had very nicely printed signs so that the English-speaking audience would know exactly what was on their minds, and they all had the same slogan. It was like within hours.
Yes, sir.
And in English. I don't. Mm-hmm. You know, when they ask me where's my vote, I have to say I have no idea. I couldn't help you. Why are they asking me?
Save the signs that pitch not to the Iranian government, but to the Western media. That's why they're English. And that's why they have green wristbands, green scarves, green blouses, shirts. It's another one of the CIA's color-coded revolutions, you know, like Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And it's completely obvious. It's obvious. It's not spontaneous. We had one of the leading neoconservatives who actually has an organization funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. That's what the United States uses to interfere in foreign elections. Mm-hmm. And the explicit purpose of this man, Kenneth Timmerman's organization, is to encourage democracy in Iran. And he wrote the day before the election that the NED money, the National Endowment for Democracy money, had gone in to pro-Mousavi groups through non-governmental organizations supported by the National Endowment for Democracy. So he's already said that the U.S. money is involved. And then he said, and this is before the election, there's no vote, no one's calling the vote, he said that there's talk in Tehran of a green revolution. Well, why in the world, if this is supposed to be spontaneous protest, especially if Mousavi and his supporters expected to win, would they already have in the work a green revolution? It's pointless.
Not only is it a color revolution, it's a color coordinated.
Yeah, right. You see, what people don't understand, because, you know, the American, first of all, it's really strange that an Iranian elector gets all this attention. A Japanese elector doesn't mm-hmm. get it. The Chinese ones doesn't. They are much more important.
Palestinian election didn't get it. At least the outcome.
The people who are all upset about Iran, they don't even know who rules Switzerland or China or Japan or Italy. I mean, they have no idea. So all of it is you know, it's, why are we so concerned about an Iranian election when we don't pay attention to anybody else's election? So, mm-hmm. But the point I was going to make is that the way the Iranian system works, if the mullahs are opposed to a candidate, they simply don't put him on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
You see, what people don't understand is that there's a small group, and among the aspiring candidates, they go through them all, they pick a handful, and put them on the ballot. So if they were opposed to Mousavi, they simply wouldn't have put him on the ballot. They certainly wouldn't have put him on the ballot and then go steal the election. They mm-hmm. simply would have kicked him off the ballot. There's no reason for them to engage in election fraud because they control who gets to run. Mm-hmm. And I think they were deceived by Mousavi. He is sort of a pillar of the establishment. He was the foreign minister in the most conservative Iranian government. And he's backed by Rafsanjani, another pillar of the establishment. And I don't think the mullahs understood that he was disaffected. I think he hid his disaffection. And then is used, and it's possible he's being manipulated by these U.S.-funded groups that are the source of money for him. It's certainly possible he's being manipulated. But I think he's disaffected, and is using the opportunity to embarrass the regime. So the mullahs made a mistake. I think if they had known of his disaffection, he would not have been on the ballot, because they have the power to decide who gets to run. I mean, it may be...
Yeah, as that fellow pointed out in the counterpoint today, ask Ralph Nader about being on ballots.
Yeah, but that's just the way... I'm not trying to compare them to the American system. I know that we can only have two candidates because there's two parties.
Yeah.
But the way it works there, there may be 100 people or 500 who want to run for president. And the mullahs get all of this, and they look at it, and they pick a handful and let them run. So if they weren't content when they picked them to have Mustafa, they simply wouldn't pick them. They're not going to pick him and then go steal the election. And this is the most
That's a very good point.
You see what I'm saying? It's so... And anybody knows anything about Iran, that's obvious. So this whole Western propaganda disinformation campaign, of course, covers all this up. No one has ever said this obvious fact.
I remember your first column after the vote, you said, let's just use some common sense here. Ahmadinejad ran on a certain kind of ticket and promises of the type that you would think would generate quite a few votes. And the guy he ran against, by the way, Mr. Mousavi, didn't exactly work hard. He didn't go around the country.
Right. He did not campaign outside a few of the larger cities. Mm-hmm. And Ahmadinejad went everywhere. Not only that, but he did the classic political thing. He put money with him. And all the country people, and the peasants, and all the rest had their share of it. So it's quite clear.
Now that's kind of politics, I understand.
Yeah, well
that's nothing mysterious about that.
This is why I think the Mousavi thing was set up from the beginning. I think he's a turncoat. Mm-hmm. I can't prove that. Yeah. But why would a moderate, first of all, he's not a moderate. He's just a hard-line foreign minister of a very conservative Iranian government. But let's assume he is a moderate now. Or let's assume he's even a reformer now, or a liberal now. I don't care what he is, but why would such a person expose the Iranian Revolution, of which he was a member, to the hostile West the way he has done? You see, however this comes out, the Iranian Revolution is discredited in the eyes of the world, the Western world, that falls for all the propaganda that we issue. And so it will be further isolated, further discredited, easier for the United States to justify a military strike, which is what the Israel lobby
has been asking
on us every day.
Yes.
And so why would Mousavi set his country up for a military strike, which is what he's doing? If, you see, he was an honest politician, just using...
Well, such things are known around the world. You have a very famous, what is his name, Benedict Arnold, sort of surprised his friends.
Well, this is speculation on my part, but my question, I think, is more than rhetorical. You have to... The mullahs regarded him as a pillar of the establishment. They were prepared to accept his victory, or they would not have let him run. They don't let anybody run if they're not prepared to have his president. And I think that he had some disaffection they didn't know about, and they made a mistake. He obviously is not sincere, because a sincere person would not expose his country to the kind of discredit that he has brought upon it. And it is a form of discredit that if we follow John Bolton, who laid out the strategy, first we try to destabilize them, failing that, we attack them.
Yes. And by the way, I want to ask you about this.
Mousavi has to know that. I mean, this is widely known. He can't not know that.
Yes.
So why
extremely
does he
dangerous.
Expose his country to this?
Yeah. No, that's I want to. There's a twist there that you and I, when we spoke earlier, I want to make sure we call attention to some very because your point is that that CIA is involved, certainly British intelligence must be, but some rather curious things happened, and one of them that I found amusing was they were passing around a letter in Tehran. Said, "Oh, we've got the smoking gun. We've got in this letter, one of the officials writes to the great leader and says." On your instructions that we fixed the election, but we wanted you to know the real numbers so that you'd just be able to put that in your pocket. Now, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? I mean, they're actually holding this up as though they believe that?
Well, it's an obvious CIA forgery because anyone who knows anything at all about Iran knows that a low-level bureaucrat never has any direct communication with the supreme leader. In fact, that's not his title. That's the title of the West is stuck on him, so we're kind of stuck using it, otherwise nobody will know what we're talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that, and furthermore, the notion that if the high mucky mucks are going to steal an election and they're going to tell some low-level bureaucrat and then let him put it in writing, I mean, it's such a transparent forgery.
Yes.
That it proves that this is a CIA destabilization job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no other way to explain such a letter.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody knows that a low-level bureaucrat never has direct communication with the top dog. This is true in our government as well.
Definitely. I mean, if you approached a leader immediately, everybody, a part of the apparatchik, would say, "Who is that guy? Why does he think he can approach the president?" You don't do that.
Well, his superior would cut his head off,
yes.
Superior of that superior would cut that superior's head off.
Mm-hmm.
Look, if everybody could do that, then the supreme leader would have thousands of communications every day and wouldn't know what he was doing.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, that's one of the problems with the monarchy, the idea that people just drop by and ask him for things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the United States, I had a very high position. And for me to have direct communication to Ronald Reagan is something that the president himself put into effect when his economic program was being opposed by his own administration, and he knew I was a loyal supporter of what he was trying to do, and so they worked out a way where I had direct contact with two of the more important people of the staff, so that information could get directed to him. Now, if the high a presidential appointee, which I was, in the Reagan administration, doesn't send a letter directed to the president, you can bet the bottom dollar that a low-level bureaucrat in Iran doesn't send one to the supreme leader.
I'm sure. We're speaking to Paul Craig Roberts, who has a brilliant column that you can find in Counterpunch today and a number of previous columns on this very subject. You've been anticipating moves against Iran over a number of years, and I want to ask you about that. You have stressed you have familiarity with how the White House runs. Could you talk about that? What's the atmosphere like? What is it about your own experience that makes you think they just went to work on this thing?
You mean that the CIA went to work?
What is it about that experience that tells you that they made some kind of decision to do this? To destabilize Iran?
Well, historically, the Eisenhower administration, and he was one of our most decent persons, destabilized the first democratic elected leader of Iran in 1953. We did what we're doing now. So we have a long history of destabilizing government. The Reagan administration, the neoconservatives in it, were out after destabilizing the Sandinistas in the Nicaragua. They overthrew that solo out in the island, the ocean somewhere.
Grenada.
It's Grenada.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an American pastime to do this. And it may surprise people, but the United States government owns most of them. I suspect they own the current Canadian government. They certainly own the British.
Certainly the Canadians think so.
Yeah, there's plenty of evidence of that. They certainly own the British government, French, German, the Berlusconi in Italy, Egypt. We now own Iraq, Jordan, Georgia, Ukraine, the Baltic Republic. We own all kinds of governments. The Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a young man, PhD dissertation chairman was the second right man in the Pentagon in the Nixon era, and he asked me to come one day and do something. And I asked him, I said, look, how do we get all these countries in the world to do what we want? Money. I said, oh, you mean foreign aid? He said, no, we just pay by the leaders. We just own them. And he wasn't proud. He was actually a decent guy. He was upset about this. He knew nothing he could do about it. It was just the way the system worked. And so being part of the system, he accepted it, but he didn't approve of it. And that's what he told me. And I wrote this. I published this one.
And I got, saw that in the column.
In the column. And I got two letters. One was from one of his aides at the time. He said, that's absolutely right. No doubt about it whatsoever. And that I was right. That Warren would approve of it. But that was beyond him to do anything about it. Even though he was the second highest man in the Pentagon. So, and I got another one from another of the people who had been in the Pentagon at the time, who also verified this was true. Well, I knew it was true because he told me. And he didn't have any reason to tell me something like that. It wasn't right, you know? I mean, he was about as patriotic and conservative as you could be. So, I think that this is
an important lesson.
It
must have been kind of a growing up point for you. There must have been a kind of a, almost like a, you know, a becoming mature to hear that.
Well, you know, at the time we had the Cold War, the Soviet Union. I mean, they were a potential threat.
Mm-hmm.
They had all those weapons. But I think even the Soviet threat, I think it was real, but I think it was overblown because it meant huge public money put into armaments, security complexes. I mean, you know, and it was always an excuse for all of our interventions in other countries, their affairs.
Mr. Roberts, before I let you go, I want to make sure I ask you this question. It was in that Counterpunch, an economist named Michael Hudson, he was commenting it on the weekend. He was interested in that conference attended by Ahmadinejad after the election where the Russians, the Chinese, they were all talking about U.S. trying to get off the dollar, as it were. Do you attach any significance to that? What do you think that might indicate?
Yes, I think it's very significant to China, Russia, Iran. Iran is an observer, and the Central Asian republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union, they've now formed this organization in order to resist American encroachments in those areas. And you might ask what in the world we're doing with military bases in former republics of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly China and Russia have asked that and seem to have gotten close.
Mm-hmm.
And also, China and Russia understand that the dollar is the main power of American identity. If the dollar was not the reserve currency, we wouldn't be able to buy so many other governments, and we wouldn't be able to pay for our imports. And so, and they also know that the dollar is under great threat from the budget deficit because we're printing money. We have no way to close the trade or budget deficit. And so, if the dollar being the reserve currency, it forces them to hold their own central bank reserves in dollars. They see that the dollar is going to rapidly depreciate. They're being forced to hold reserves that have no future. So they're looking for a way out of it for both reasons, for financial reasons and for political reasons. They don't want to accept the dollar any longer as the primary tool of American identity.
Sounds like a very important meeting. Mr. Roberts, I'm really glad I asked that question, and I want to thank you very much for your terrific columns at Counterpunch, and look forward to reading more, and thanks very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you for sharing your audience.
Thank you. Talk again soon, I hope.
All right.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. That's Paul Craig Roberts. He is a former Undersecretary of State in the Ronald Reagan administration. He is writes brilliant columns, and many of them appear in Counterpunch. Recommend you go to that. This has been the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I think I got that right. For Phil Conlon, Eric, I want to thank you very much, and we'll be with you next week.